Welcome to the Real Python Podcast. This is episode 289. With the mountains of Python code that it's possible to generate now, how's your code review going? What are the limitations of human review, and where does machine review excel? Christopher Trudeau is back on the show this week with another batch of PyCoders Weekly articles and projects. We discuss a recent piece from Glyph titled, What is Code Review For? We dig into the limitations of human review and where software tools like linters and formatters can help you. We cover the challenges developers and open source maintainers face with the rise of LLM-generated code and pull requests. We also share several other articles and projects from the Python community, including a collection of recent releases and announcements, creating publication-ready tables from data frames, choosing the right Python task queue, mastering context managers, statically checking Python dictionaries for completeness, an open-source inventory management system, and an ORM-based backend for Django tasks. If you're building web apps that need live web data, this is worth a look. SERP API is a web search API that returns structured results from search engines. You can call it using their Python client, SERP API, and get clean JSON results. No scraping, no proxies, no CAPTCHAs. Just a simple way to integrate live search data into your apps. Check them out at serpapi.com. All right, let's get started. The Real Python Podcast is a weekly conversation about using Python in the real world. My name is Christopher Bailey, your host. Each week, we feature interviews with experts in the community and discussions about the topics, articles, and courses found at realpython.com. After the podcast, join us and learn real-world Python skills with a community of experts at realpython.com. Hey, Chris. Short break this time. Back-to-back PyCoders episodes.
Yeah.
So we got some releases, a couple news items, our typical topics, a discussion, and actually a few projects this week I'm excited to share. You ready to dig in?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay.
Starting off with some release news. First, DuckDB 1.5 has come out. If you're not familiar, DuckDB is an analytical database system with Python bindings. This release includes a rewrite of their command line tool, so it now includes colorization, more info about the database you're attached to, and they implemented the underscore character meaning the last result thing. They also included a new experimental PEG parser, which will mean better suggestions and improved error messages down the road. Getting a little feeling of deja vu with that one.
Yeah.
The other release announcement is PyPy 7.3.21. PyPy is an alternate Python interpreter that includes a just-in-time compiler, which can improve the speed of your code. This release is a bug fix release, and it is compatible with the syntax of Python 2.7 and 3.11. And in a sadder piece of news, the open source initiative JazzBand is sunsetting. They were a coding cooperative that maintained over 70 projects, many of which were for the Django ecosystem. Some of the more popular ones included Django Redis, Django Nose, and Django Tagit, but there were loads more. JazzBand's model was very open. Anyone could PR. That's kind of the whole idea. And that's kind of become untenable from the mass of AI submissions. So they've announced they're winding down. The projects, of course, will still be around and people may still maintain them, but the joint initiative is now gone.
So we have one other piece of news that I want to mention. We've mentioned these projects so often from Astral, and yesterday, as far as this recording goes, Astral has been acquired. It says Astral to join OpenAI. There's an announcement that I'll include the link to, but for kind of a little more information on it, I'll include a link to Simon Willison's blog about it. He's much more deeper in these conversations with other developers. We're not sure what's going to happen with it, but it's intriguing to see this. Astral was looking for funding. That's something that I brought up in our conversation last year with Charlie Marsh. I guess this will help continue the funding in a lot of ways. There's also a lot of talent inside of Astral as far as on the Rust side of tooling and things like that. I guess we'll just have to see how this shakes out. There's a nice link here if you want to dive deeper. Simon's blog post is called Thoughts on OpenAI Acquiring Astral and UV Rough Tie.
Will Vincent had an interesting piece as well called OpenAI Acquiring Astral. So we can check either of those links out.
Yeah. Okay. Let's dive into topics this week. I featured a few things after my interview with Quinn Tron at CodeCut. And actually, I have two kind of items. One I'm just going to mention. The first, though, is kind of a repeat for me. I had the guys on from Great Tables. The subtitle is Publication Ready Tables from Data Frames. Michael Chow and Richard Ione came on the show in episode 214. I mentioned being such a big fan of it. I just really think it's kind of cool when you can create stuff that really looks production or publication ready, you know, this type of stuff you'd see in a magazine or you'd see in a really nice presentation. And this tool is really nice for doing that sort of stuff. Quinn, in her style, has created this tutorial that takes you through several examples of some of these highlight features along with the code and then also how these tables are going to look as you create them. If you're not familiar with it, it's a tool for creating these quality tables out of Polars or Pandas data frames, just to make them more presentable and, you know, again, go beyond the typical like displaying of a data frame or a spreadsheet or something like that. So the tool provides things like value formatting, transforming raw numbers into currencies, percentages, dates, and more. Structural stuff about the table, like adding headers, like additional sort of subheaders, column spanning things. So like if you want to have a header that's above a pair of columns or something like that, row labels, source notes at the bottom, data-driven coloring. So things like conditional formatting or heat mapping kind of stuff you can do with it. And then inline visualizations. If you ever have seen the feature of spark lines or nano plots, as some people call them, directly inside table cells to get a quick view of what's happening. And then additional conditional stylings, again, kind of continuing on that additional conditional formatting thing I was mentioning before. And that's really what the tutorial takes you through. Great Tables comes from the R ecosystem. It's from Posit, coming from the R Studio world. And so in a similar fashion to a lot of their other tools, there is an included data set, which is nice. So you can start playing around without having to go find additional data to bring in and import. You can actually just import from greattables.data, import S&P 500, and it'll give you a historical S&P 500 stock data, which again, can be pretty handy. So her first example is about value formatting, using the format currency method, adding dollar signs and formats of decimals, and then showing off the format date, FMT underscore date, converts date strings to readable formats, including like days of the week, formatting numbers if you want it to be compact, whereas if you have large numbers, things that are like in millions or billions, it'll add the Bs or the Ms or other things to it. And then a quick way to hide columns that maybe are in the data set, but you just want to quickly in your table here, you want to hide. The next is a short one showing off how to do formatting of percentages. And then she talks about exporting, which is nice, again, than this where you can export to a PNG file, a BMP file, or even a PDF for sharing or, again, putting maybe like in a slide deck. The next example gets into more publication-ready features like adding the headers that I mentioned before, markdown formatting inside of your table, so you can add like bolding and other markdown kind of features, the source notes thing, so at the bottom you can have those additional notes, adding spanners above the columns, like in this case there's a quarterly sales report, and so that's the header would show that there's a pair of quarterly results, Q1 and Q2. Above it would be the revenue, and then another pair of columns to the right, which is like units sold. And you just kind of have to look at them to get an idea. Again, you've probably seen these in financial reports or, again, in like a magazine. The piece continues with coloring data using this heat map style for visualization in a table, and then an additional example of like conditional formatting. She also shows an interesting feature of the nano plots inside the cells, giving you these nice little mini visualizations as they appear. And you can do like lines or columns. And again, it's a really flexible library. We touched on some additional features in the interview, such as image embedding or interactive tables. There's lots of examples on their own site in the documentation. And one thing I really like about it is that in their examples, not only do you get to see, you know, what they look like visually, but they include the code that is used to create them, which is nice. And then they also have a great blog post for great tables where they have not only information about how to use them, but more examples that you can kind of dig into. So if you're interested in making publication ready tables, it's a nice library. On the flip side of that, I'm going to mention another thing from Quintron. Her article is Comparing PDF Table Extraction Tools. If you have ever thought, oh, I'll just highlight this table inside of the PDF and be able to pull that information out and got weird results. PDFs organize information very interestingly. They have kind of a grid system of X and Ys, and that's where things are included. And that information also includes like the lines along with the data that you're trying to pull out of there. So she explores three different Python tools for PDF table extraction, one called DocLean, another one named Marker, and then Llama Parse. They all have different levels of quality in working with these types of things, especially if they are fancier tables like the ones we were just describing creating. And this is all from ones that are generated from another software program, let alone if you were dealing with one that had been scanned in and trying to pull the tables out. I was looking for some tools like that before. Now you're dealing with like OCR and other kinds of things that might cause it to be even more difficult. The one that she's using in this particular example across all these libraries is a research doc, and she runs it through the different tools to compare and contrast them. And it's a nice another survey of resources for you if you're working with tables, in this case, on the opposite side of it. Say you're building an API app, a research tool, or even a simple automation script in Python. At some point, you need fresh data from the web. With SERP API, you can fetch real-time results from Google, Amazon, and more using a simple API call. The response is structured JSON, so it fits right into your Python workflow. You can pass it into pandas, feed it into an LLM, or use it in your backend logic. You don't have to deal with scraping infrastructure, rotating proxies, or getting blocked. Companies like NVIDIA, Perplexity, and Shopify already rely on SERP API. There's also a free tier, so you can test it out. It's fast, simple, and easy to integrate into your existing projects. Check them out at serpapi.com. That's serpapi.com. So what's your first one here?
My first article is by Jeff Morehouse, and it's called Choosing the Right Python Task Queue. Task queues are systems that allow you to push your compute jobs into it. They work on them and then store the results for your later retrieval. They're commonly used in web programming when you've got longer running calculations to do. So you might show the user a job submitted page, then stick their thing in the queue, let the user then come back later to see if their job is done. You do this instead of just, say, waiting for the page to load for the work to happen, because otherwise you get a stall on the page and it looks bad. There are a few different queues out there that you can use with your Python. This article goes over the two most popular, Celery and RQ, and it covers the basic capabilities of both of them, comparing them, and then helps you choose the best fit for your need. To start with, Celery is the big one. It's a distributed task queue system, meaning you can run it on multiple machines, giving you more scalability and parallelism. It supports tools for serializing data, scheduling, and lots more. And all of this capability, of course, comes at the cost of complexity, and so it's got a bit of a learning curve. A popular alternative to Celery is RQ, which stands for Redis Queue. It's much lighter weight, and it sits on top of Redis, which is an in-memory key-value data store. Since it sits in memory, this one tends to be super quick, but it doesn't have all the features that Celery does. To start off, Jeff compares the two in a little chart. The first entry in the chart is simplicity, which he gives to RQ. The second entry is job scheduling, which only Celery does. The third is prioritization, which both of them can do. And the last is the creation of tasks from non-Python apps, which only Celery can do. So you can see the capabilities thing kind of going on here. The table on its own might be enough for you to make your decision, depending on what your queuing needs are. The article goes on to compare performance, and although Celery is the more complex beast, due to its scalability, it handles large loads better. Celery can also be paired with a Redis broker, meaning RQ, which is built on the same tech, doesn't really have a lead here. The broker idea that I just mentioned, that's the back-end component that is responsible for storing and dealing with tasks. The next comparison in the article is about reliability. As Redis is an in-memory system, if you're using it as the broker, you don't really get power failure reliability. Celery lets you configure what broker to use, and, well, the R in RQ is Redis, so you don't have much choice. The RabbitMQ broker, which can be used with Celery, includes reliable message delivery, so if you need safety, Celery is definitely the way to go. The rest of the article highlights a couple of less popular alternatives, Huey and Dramatique, as well as goes into more details about how to choose those back-end brokers. All in all, if you're trying to figure out which task queue to use, Jeff's article is a great place to start.
Would you mind just pointing out like an application situation here that would use this? Like I can think of, you know, the tasks as an idea, but are we talking like these are like requests coming in from customers potentially? Or
yeah, it's almost always anything that requires more compute than you can do immediately to show a web page, right? So right. Overly simplified example that you don't necessarily need a task queue for, but something like resizing profile pictures.
Okay.
So the user uploads a profile picture, and inside of your system, you want like 5 different sizes available depending on which page it's going to display on. Well, there's some crunchiness that has to happen for that to run.
Right.
So you don't do that on the page where the person uploads it, because otherwise they'd have to wait for that to happen. So you have to somehow stick it into a background.
Okay.
And a task queue would be one of the ways of doing that. Yeah.
Yeah, cool. All right. So my next one is something, again, if you're moving from being sort of a beginner Python coder and you start looking at some more intermediate stuff, you're like, well, how does this work? This next one is by Mohammed Hazian, and he likes to go by Mo, M-O-H, and it's on his HaziMed Tech website, which we've featured a few times. It also includes additional articles about Python and Django. So the piece is titled Mastering Python Context Managers Beyond Just With Open. So the end of the title is referring to the most common example you'll typically see for a context manager. If you're working with files, especially like maybe a text file is a common example that people put out here, you'll see this opening of a file inside of a with statement. But if you're opening a file in order to like read it or edit it, and then you move on in your code and you say, forget to close it, which is something you need to do when you're done, you can kind of run into some weird errors with that file and some other problems down the road. So similarly, if you're connecting to a database inside your code, you need to manage that connection, sort of committing of changes and closing that connection once you're done. And that's really where this idea of a context manager comes in. But you may also have thought like, oh, well, what is this magic that's happening under the hood? And you might have also thought about like, well, what if I wanted to make my own? I have some other kind of context that I'm going to want to be able to walk inside. So he states that a context manager is an object that does 3 different things. It prepares a resource for you. It lets you use it. And then it cleans up when you're done, even if an error happens. So he shows the common example I referred to before, which would be with open parentheses, the name of the file, in this case, data.txt as file. And then underneath that, contents equals file.read. So then you have this object of contents that's contained with everything that's inside of it. And as you leave the context of the with statement there, the file, the data.txt has been closed. You can still use what's been created inside of contents. So the with statement sort of simplifies resource management. It handles the setup and cleanup automatically. And when the block ends, file close is automatically called, even if there could be an exception. he shows the code. If you didn't have this context manager, you'd need to have your own try finally block. And in the finally block, you'd have to include the file close method. Under the hood, a context manager uses two special methods. Special methods are the ones that we refer to often with the two underscores before and after their names, also sometimes called magic or dunder methods because of the two underscores. And so dunder enter, so underscore, underscore, enter, underscore, underscore, which takes self, runs at the start of the with block, and then there's another one that's paired with it, dunder exit, which includes a couple other parameters like exception type or exception value and a traceback, which would run at the end, even if the error happens. So he shares a more complete code example of building one, defining the class, and then adding the dunder methods. And the piece then shares some more common use cases. File handling, we mentioned already, with open. Again, the block finishes with the close method. He talks about the database connections again that we just discussed. Many database APIs in Python act as context managers, committing or again rolling back automatically in case the changes weren't needed. In this case, he shows a bit of code, how a SQLite connection would work. And then threading is another common one. So you might want to be able to lock. It's crucial to lock resources to avoid conflicts when working with threads. Kind of interesting one at the tail of these examples is decimal precision. As Mr. Trudeau often says, never use floats when dealing with currency. And so decimal precision and using the decimal class might be something you might look at. In this case, his example is limiting precision to four digits during part of some equations that you might be doing, and then it defaulting back to whatever the precision was once the block ends. So then the piece goes into quickly showing you, well, what if you wanted to implement this yourself? And he shows creating the class and again, creating the dunder enter and the dunder exit methods. He also shows another example of class-based context managers creating a database connection. He quickly references right at the very tail of this, another way that you can implement context management. It's using a library context_lib, which creates a function-based context manager, which is basically a decorator that's wrapping around a generator. So a couple concepts that are kind of beyond the scope of what this particular article was covering. But if you'd like more, if you look through it and you're like, oh, this looks really interesting, you want to dive much deeper, our friend Leah Donis has got that covered for you. There's a pretty good deep dive on Real Python for you. And then there's also a video course by Mr. Trudeau himself that gives you a nice tour of context managers. And I'll include links to both of them. A handy tool built into Python to help manage your relationship with files or databases or other things like that without having to do a whole lot under the hood. What do you got next?
I've got an article by Luke Plant, who we've featured three times before. The post is titled Statically Checking Python Dicks for Completeness. The premise is fairly simple. Say you've got an enum that describes four states of a water tank: full, half full, nearly empty, and empty. Then somewhere else in your GUI code, you want to map those four states to some color codes. Since the enum is about the state of the thing, it really doesn't make sense to include the color information in the enum. So a common solution is to have a separate dictionary that maps the enum states to the corresponding colors. This is good design, and it separates concerns. The flaw in the design is when you decide to add a new state, you have to remember to add the new color entry elsewhere in your code. And oftentimes that GUI code is in a completely different file, maybe a different directory, and you might not be local to that enum and you might not remember. Since the enum can be treated as a type, you might think that a type checker could solve this problem, but unfortunately, the current state of Python type checking can't deal with this situation. What Luke has done to solve the problem is to include a for loop in his code near the color dictionary that loops over all of the values in the enum and asserts that there's an equivalent key in the color dictionary. This code might seem a little weird at first, but by being in line with the color dictionary declaration, it gets run when the module loads. So if you add something to the enum, you'll get an assertion failure immediately, rather than finding that you're missing a color when you say go to use it. Luke liked this solution so much, he wrote a helper function. The helper expects a type hint on the dictionary that describes what types the keys and values are. So for our color dictionary, the keys would be of the tank enum type. The helper function then takes the dictionary as an argument, uses this type hint to know what to loop over, then performs the asserts. As the assertion loop is only two lines of code, this only saves a single line each usage, but it's a little clearer as naming the function something like assert complete enumerations dict is a little more self-explanatory than the funky little for loop that you might not be expecting. So a small idea, but helpful one, something you might try out for yourself.
It's time to shine a spotlight on another RealPython resource. Quick heads up, we just opened registration for the next cohort of our Intermediate Python Deep Dive course. And I want to share something one of our past participants said. Matt Thacker, a senior solutions engineer, told us, honestly, just the first 2 weeks of this course was worth it for me. It's given me more confidence to go deep dive into things I took for granted. And Jerry Wilson, a technical lead, said he can now look at other people's code and understand not just what it does, but why they wrote it that way. That's the difference this course makes. It's 8 weeks with Steven Grappetta covering object-oriented programming, special methods, iterators, decorators, closures, advanced data structures, the stuff that separates working code from professional grade code, small cohorts, live classes, real feedback on your work. If you'd like to hear more stories from participants of the course, check out episode 246. The next cohort starts May 11th. Head to realpython.com/live for the full syllabus. And we'll put a link in the show notes. Well, we got a discussion this week. This one is on a topic that we've touched before on the show about code review. So what's the article you're sharing?
Yeah, it's based on an article by Glyph that's titled, What is a Code Review For? And it takes a bit of a right turn, but we'll get there. The article starts by pointing out just how bad humans are at catching errors. He mentions four well-known psychological effects that impact our ability to see problems. The first is inattentional blindness. That's not being able to find something that you're not looking for. So there's a famous experiment on this where people watch a video of basketball and they're asked to count how many times the ball is dribbled in the segment. And then partway through the segment, a man in a gorilla costume walks through the frame. And a significant percentage of people in the test fail to see the gorilla. Being tightly focused on counting the number of times the ball hits the ground, the thing you're asked to look for, makes you inattentive to other things. The second effect is repetition blindness. If things keep happening a lot, you're likely to miss one of them. The third effect is vigilance fatigue. The longer you need to be alert, the less effective you become. And somewhat related to that is alert fatigue. If you get a lot of warnings or false positives, you're likely to miss a real problem. Given all of this stuff, the best advice then is to use tools to catch most problems. So automated tests, formatters, linters, and security scanners go a long way. And you've actually had guests who talk about this and how it works with code reviews.
Yeah, episode 183, if you would like a deeper dive into this, I had Brendan McGinnis and Nick Thapin from Sorcery, and they literally make a tool that is for not only reviewing code, but looking at ways that you might want to refactor it. I think of it as a neat tool, even if you wanted to give it a try, because it goes through and provides gentle suggestions like, maybe look at this part of your code or look at this part. So again, kind of like automating the process. But our conversation was really nice because I wanted to ask them who've been in the field for a long time, like, well, what is it like to do code reviews? What was it like to do code reviews within their own company? Ways that they provided advice beyond ways that we just discussed here of like automating it inside of Python. So yeah, Sorcery is a nice additional tool to look at for ways that you might actually want to look through your code. And there's a lot more code being generated than ever, which is be part of our conversation here.
Yeah, I think that's part of the trickiness of all of this. You'd think with Glyph's thesis being, hey, we suck at this, that the conclusion would be is, you know, don't do them or just let the tools do them. But he actually points out that there are things we should be trying to catch that the machines don't do well. So the first is process failures. So if you keep seeing the same kinds of bugs, even from your electronic tools, say something like an SQL injection, then you should be having conversations about your process for catching those and making sure that people are educated so that they don't keep happening. Second is an opportunity for those who are more familiar with code to walk through it with those who are less familiar. So it gives a chance for people to learn and ask questions.
Yeah.
And this kind of conversation can help stop accidental duplication in the code as well. Because I might go to write a routine because I need a utility that does X. And if it's already there, if I'm not familiar, I'm more likely to do that.
I think that process of like onboarding somebody and them having to sit down and look at the code base.
Yes. It's daunting.
Yeah. And having them come with a bunch of questions is actually probably a really positive experience for a lot of the engineers too, for like them to go, yeah, why are we doing it like that?
Exactly. Well, and that kind of leads to the third one here, which is to help to break the team out of a rut. It can be particularly effective when you add new people to the team, because sometimes they might, you know, those questions might cause you to go, yeah, actually, maybe that wasn't such a good choice. Or there might be a better way of doing something that, you know, using a technique that that person has used at a previous place. So far, this has been more of an article summary than a discussion.
Yeah.
And this is where it goes off the rails. So the next section is titled, oops, surprise, this post is actually about LLMs again.
Yeah.
Glyph has some rather strong opinions on this. And really what the article gets into from this point is just that the use of LLMs is going to change how and why and when we need to do things like code reviews, and it probably makes them more important.
Yeah. I've been waiting to talk about this for a while, but I've been watching a lot of people creating a lot of code and them all having this kind of weird reaction, like, I'm more productive than I've ever been. And I jokingly think that they're on performance-enhancing drugs of different kinds, not unlike the movies of the 70s and so forth. But the...
You can just say cocaine.
Okay, people will cocaine. Understand. They're totally on cocaine. And yes, they're being crazy, crazy productive, but suddenly they're extremely tired. And then they're also like feeling this crushing weight of all this code they've created because they're sort of responsible for it. And even though this machine has helped them create a lot of it, the security of it, the reviewing of it that we're discussing right now, is still squarely in their lap. And, you know, like I said, they're responsible for what this is doing and what it's supposed to be doing. And it's a interesting dilemma. It's like, yeah, you can create a whole bunch of stuff. And it's like, well, you know, should you do it to a point where you can't review it and get through it and look at it? So yeah, I think this is where we dig into.
Yeah, Simon Wilson had a post a few months back that I've kind of tucked away for future use, that the title was, "Your job is to deliver code you have proven to work." And this is kind of where LLMs get interesting, right? Like, yes, your job isn't actually just the code. Your job is working code.
Right.
So his argument was sort of, let's ignore how it got generated. It's almost irrelevant how it got generated. But if you're failing to deliver something that's working, then you're failing at your job, right? And that, you know, to tie us back to things like the code reviews, one of the challenges with reviewing what a machine has generated is the kinds of errors that you see might be different. You know, I've had colleagues who use these tools, you know, tell me, oh, it's kind of like having, you know, a junior co-op, right? And like so for certain kinds of work, it's great. But then the problem is they go off the rails in ways that a junior co-op wouldn't go off the rails. So like you might be less likely to have certain kinds of bugs, but then when they're wrong, it's a complete misunderstanding. So you have to catch different kinds of things that you wouldn't.
Yeah. There's a couple of things there that I think are interesting too, like that LLMs very often will write code from first principles. Like they'll just do the most straightforward thing and not use like a library or other tools that are there. They'll just repeat themselves often, mm-hmm. which is interesting, instead of like things that could be potentially organized into something that's a little more parsable as a human, like a function call. It'll just, you know, write out the code directly and do it several times because that was the simplest path maybe for it to sort of think through. There's a lot of these kind of telltale things, and I don't know how much that's been addressed, you know, as far as like coding agents go in part of this And a lot of people are like, well, whatever, it's just a lot more code. And it's like, yeah, but again, your goal is to maintain it in one way or another.
You know, I keep seeing sort of like two kinds of articles, right? There's the article of, I've created all this stuff. And then I see the articles where it's like Google saying they think they've improved their productivity by 10%, right?
Right.
And I think the fundamental difference in those two situations is Google is trying to create production, maintainable production code.
Right.
If I'm trying to produce something that is a one-off that solves my problem, great. Let it generate something for me.
Yeah, sure.
And that's with or without the LLM, there's a difference in how you do that, right? Like I've got scripts that I never look at again. I wrote them once. They do the thing that I need to do. I'm not maintaining them. And they don't have a lot of comments. And if I ever go look at it again, I have to reread what was I doing here and how did that work? And then I've got stuff that I use regularly and other people depend on me for. And that's written in a different style. The productivity gain probably is closely related to which kind of those things you are trying to do, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's the conversation I had a long time ago about becoming a professional in the industry is this idea of like being able to refactor code and be able to organize code and make it extensible and so forth. And these are conversations that I feel like some of the stuff is just bypassing by just generating more code.
Yeah. Well, the flip side of it is these tools are also able to do things that are like code reviews.
Yes, true.
And so some of that fatigue and things that we were talking about, or, you know, the analysis, the article mentions several times that people can only handle about 400 lines at a time and then your brain just melts and that's it, you're done. Well, you can throw the machine at much larger chunks than that.
Right.
And I think this is one, you know, once the hype cycle disappears, and it will, I think one of the survivors is going to be things like, hey, summarize this chunk of code for me, or here's 500,000 lines of code. Tell me where it does this thing so that you can go find stuff and how it's related. So I think there's like a companion-esque, coder's companion kind of thing that is probably going to be maintained out of this. And you and I were talking the other day about the whole, you know, cloud versus local, whatever.
Right.
That's the other aspect is, you know, that companion thing could be local. So the open source models for this could survive even if some of these hype companies implode when the money runs out.
Yeah. It's an interesting time for that. I have a quick question that's kind of related to the 400 lines of reading code and keeping that in your head, sort of your own personal context window. I have always been an extremely slow reader, and I think in some ways it's helpful in this case. In other cases, it's like it takes me forever to go through books, and I've kind of became an audiobook person pretty early on just because I can kind of do other things because it takes me a while to kind of go through books. I'm very methodical. I read every word, and you know, and I know there's a huge number of people that have been taught to just skim and go through, and I'm like, I don't know if that works well for coding, right?
It doesn't.
Yeah.
Whether coding or anything else, like I'm a fairly fast reader, but I am very, very aware that as I increase my reading speed, my retention drops. And of course, the whole purpose of code review isn't to get through 1,000 lines quickly,
right?
Like if I'm reading a business article and I know it's going to be 90% fluff, I can skim, find the thing that's interesting, and then slow down. In a code review, that's dangerous.
Yeah.
And because that's not the purpose of it, right? The purpose of it is to go over it in detail. I honestly, like, I hate doing them. I really do. It's like vegetables. I know I have to eat them. Nice. I know I'm not saying you shouldn't do them, but I don't like reading my code. I really don't like reading other people's code. Yeah, I find it it's a necessary process, but I find it a very painful process. Yeah.
I think the automation thing of the things that we've discussed before in this, you know, whole idea is that a code review shouldn't be about style. And maybe we can get to, you know, again, code formatting tools that get rid of that, you know, linters, get rid of some of the common smaller errors. And hopefully these LLM tools would potentially help with flagging things, you know, like,
yeah.
Please look here. This is where it looks kind of odd to, you know, this tool, which is, I think, could make that a more pleasant experience than, again, parsing line by line.
Yeah. The challenge, it's always going to come down to the the balancing act, though, of the false positives.
Yeah.
Because that, and having not used these a lot myself, I don't know exactly where that, where the current state of the art is with the, with that balance. But I find the problem is if it starts flagging something and then you have to go digging, because I've had a couple people open bugs on my libraries.
Yes.
That weren't there. And that was an hour of my life gone because I had to try to figure out, well, what are they saying? And is it doing it? And then it's like, no, that code does not do that, right? So false positives are as much of a problem as finding bugs are, because that there's a cost to that, right?
Yeah, that's the other flip side of this, that go back to the jazz band announcement.
Yep.
yeah. Just like them getting overwhelmed by these, I don't know. I mean, they're submissions, but they're submissions from, you know, people that haven't taken the time to prove what the thing is that they're doing. And that process, like I always hear people sort of bugged at the glacial pace that Apple handles a lot of their bugs. But they require you to do like a submission through a specific, you know, harness that like gives them a bunch of
yes.
data and so yeah. forth. And that's not something I think an individual like yourself is going to be able to set up.
No.
Yeah.
No. Well, I, you know, one of the ones I got was somebody not happy with one of my files being named .rst, which is a markdown-like text mechanism, which is perfectly viable.
Right.
But there are some Rust programmers name their files RST and they're supposed to be RS. So I got a part of a mass fix thing that was trying to name all of my RST files to RS. There isn't any Rust in that library.
Right.
It was all text. So like, obviously this person hadn't even spent a moment to figure out what that file was, what the library did, what any of it was. It was wow. just, oh, it ends in RST. I found a file on GitHub that ends in RST, therefore I'll submit a pull request, right?
Right.
And
it supposedly said Python based upon, you know, some other yeah. flag here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Crazy.
So, yeah. So, like, that's, and like I said, that one wasn't hard. As soon as I saw the PR, I was like, that's weird. That's insane. But it did cost the 5 minutes to close it and muck with it, right? So, yeah. Anyways.
As much as you dislike eating your vegetables here, do you feel as a skill that you get better at it over time?
Sure. Yeah. Like with anything, it's practice. And that's... I would generalize that to reading code. Practice helps with those things. You get better at it. And the code review aspect really is just a subset of that, because that's what you're doing. You're reading someone else's code. And so, yeah, it's just a matter of figuring out how to read people's code and what works. The other thing that will happen too is this is usually done in a team setting. The whole process is social. And your teams will set up patterns as well. It's not just you get better at reading code, you get better at reading each other's code because you know what each other's styles are and you understand, you know, what their thinking is. You also learn over time, hopefully, what things to make a fuss about and what things not to make a fuss about.
Yeah.
So, and that's a different dynamic on different teams, right? So some teams will be very rigid about something, some will be looser. And as you go through, if it turns out, oh, you know, this team doesn't care about this thing, although I might think it's important, after the fifth time I've brought it up and I've been told to shut up, I should learn to shut up, right? So,
yeah.
So, yeah, so there's a practice aspect of it, both in the skill side and the social side. Yeah.
Yeah. That hit most of what you wanted to?
Yeah, I think, okay. You know, as an end note, eat your broccoli, boys and girls. It's good for you.
As long as it's prepared well.
Yes. Yes.
Not overcooked like potentially our parents did.
Covering it in cheese makes it consumable, but I think that's antithetical. So,
yeah, could yes. be. Yeah. All right, well, let's dig into projects. I have two that I want to share. One is very, very quick. It's titled US data sets. I think people are often wanting to try out the tools as they're learning Python or learning data science and need some data sets, some things to play around with. And we've provided other resources before, but this is a nice package that you can grab right off PyPI. And it's got a bunch of comprehensive data sets ready to go about the United States. again, the United States may not be as popular right now, but anyway. but it's designed for data analysis, education, and research in Python. It's by Renzo Carceres Rossi, and the collection covers historical political information, crime stats, wage and income data, election results, mortality rates, presidential information, education metrics, NFL statistics, stock market data, entertainment industry records. So kind of an interesting mix of things. Hopefully you'd find something of interest if you potentially would like it. The link is to actually the PyPI piece on it. So again, ready for you to pip install.
Yeah. In fact, this particular maintainer has a bunch of them as well. So if you go off to the PyPI page for this and click on the author, he's got legal data sets, neural data sets, time series data sets, med data, crime data, US data. So there's a whole bunch there as well. So if you're going digging, look him up and you may find some more.
Thanks, Renzo. All right. So the second one is a large project, and often we don't feature these more complete things, but I think it could inspire you if you're looking for a project that, you know, spans across a lot of stuff, like database and web stuff, and even potentially working on iOS devices or Android devices, you know, mobile. This project is called InventTree, kind of a play on inventory. It's an open source inventory management system. It's on GitHub, and it's by a team of four and then a whole bunch of contributors. There's Oliver, who goes by Schrodinger's Gat. He's an Australian EE, electrical engineer or electronics engineer, I'm guessing, who started the project in 2017. And then there's Francois, who's another electrical engineer, Matthias, who's an Austrian dev, and Luca, who's a German student who's focused on their plugin development. It's really well documented. If you go to inventree.org, their site, you can find the documentation. There's actually a stood up example site that you can use some custom built-in logins to play around with it. And there's a bunch of contributors, like I mentioned, like 139 people, along with sponsors, which is good to see as far as the health of the project. It seems rather popular. There's like 3 million Docker pulls and almost 7,000 GitHub stars. So pretty popular inventory management system. It's designed to provide low-level stock control and park tracking. The core of the system is Python Django. So again, something that we feature often on the show. The Django has the database backend, and it provides an admin interface that's web-based, and then a REST API for interaction with external interfaces and applications. And then a plugin system. In fact, the most recent plugin system was connected to like a Zebra labeling system, which I think is kind of cool. The GitHub page has links to the project roadmap, and then a lot of the integration, like the Python part of it, the plugin section of it, third-party tools, and the whole tech stack that's underneath it. So I think it's kind of unique. I mean, I don't usually see these type of projects shared that also have companion apps that are available in the Android or Apple app stores. So yeah, check it out. If you're looking for something, it's a very cool, large project that you can kind of take and fork into your own if you're interested, or just maybe learn a little bit about how a large project might be put together. There's a few mentions of Hacktoberfest, so I'm thinking maybe it's been featured a few times for people to come in and contribute to it through that. All right, what do you got?
I've got something somewhat related to the Task Queue article that I spoke of earlier. Project is called Django Tasks DB, and it's by Jake Howard, who goes by The Real Orange One on GitHub. As I mentioned when I introduced the article, a common use of task queues is for long-running processes for web servers. This is so common that there are a load of tools out there that work with Django, Celery being one of them. Django 6 recently added an interface for task queues. They didn't write a task queue into the framework, just a way of talking to one. This works kind of like the database interface. You tell Django what kind of system you want to talk to, then use pluggable code to talk to that server or service. The result is a standard mechanism for talking to task queues, and then you could swap them out with very little change to your code. Jake's project is a task queue implementation that uses the Django ORM to manage tasks in your database. This means you don't have to set up a separate task queue server. The existing Django framework and your existing database are all you need. The asynchronous aspect of running the tasks gets handled by a Django management command called dbworker. You run it, and that's what processes all the tasks in the system. The project kind of reminds me of SQLite. It's a useful little tool that comes with Django with very little extra, and it solves a particular problem. And at scale, you probably want to replace it. But because it requires so little energy to get going, it's probably a good place to start. So if you need a task runner for Django, this might be your first one out there.
Yeah, something nice and lightweight to get going. All right. Well, thanks, Christopher, for bringing all these articles and projects this week.
Glad to be here. See you soon.
And don't forget, if you want to bring real-time search data into your Python projects, check out SERP API. It's fast, simple, and easy to integrate with your existing projects. You can start for free and build something useful right away. Go to serpapi.com/playground and try it out. I want to say thanks to Christopher Trudeau for coming on the show again this week. And I want to thank you for listening. If you like the episode, a great way to help us grow our audience is to share it with other Python users who you think might enjoy it. You can also leave a rating or a review on your podcast platform of choice. If you or your company are interested in sponsoring the podcast, you can find all the information at realpython.com/advertise. You can find show notes with links to the topics we spoke about inside your podcast player or at realpython.com/podcast. And while you're there, you can leave us a question or a topic idea. I've been your host, Christopher Bailey, and I look forward to talking to you soon.